Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on VBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. And by the Rockstar Chronicles. That's my new book, featuring over 45 intimate conversations with the greatest music legends the world will ever know. It's available now at bookbaby.com and amazon.com. Well, Danny Zalisco began promoting concerts in Arizona in 1974. He founded the legendary concert promoting firm called Evening Star Productions. That brought worldwide attention to the young estate on the U.S. mainland by the entertainment industry. He became known as one of the world's best promoters and talent buyers, a true rainmaker when it comes to discovering and booking talent in all sorts of situations. Beginning with promoting concerts at Dooley's Nightclub, in Tempe, Zalisco and his team promoted hundreds of new and veteran bands and facilities across the valley. Acts such as The Police, Cheap Trick, Pat Benatar, Talking Heads, Kiss, Bon Jovi, No Doubt, and Nirvana, among others. They all performed at the intimate venue from its opening in 1976 until its closed after several ownerships and name changes in the mid-90s. Nightclub concerts by recording stars began happening all over the country, with Zalisco leading his territory in the area of booking. In the 80s, Zalisco's company and staff grew. He became the state's most prominent concert promoter, producing hundreds of shows each year, while also becoming New Mexico's busiest promoter. Evening Star also promoted shows in almost every state in the USA during the 80s and 90s, while promoting shows in every venue, small and large alike, all over the Southwest, including Vets Memorial Coliseum, the original home of the Phoenix Suns, then America West Arena, now known as U.S. Airways Center. Pink Floyd and Paul McCartney were among the stadium events promoted by Evening Star. By the year 2000, consolidation of concert promoters began by SFX, as they bought up many of the country's biggest promoters, including Bill Graham Presents from San Francisco, Electric Factory from Philadelphia, Don Law from Boston, Pace Concert from Texas, and many, many more. Evening Star joined the ranks of those fabled promoters by selling to SFX in 2001. Zalisco became president of the Southwest office of SFX. A few years later, Clear Channel Communications, they bought SFX, and Zalisco and his staff became part of Clear Channel Entertainment. In 2006, Clear Channel spun the entertainment division and all of its promoters and venues into what is now called Live Nation, where Zalisco remained as president and then chairman of Live Nation Southwest until he left his post in 2011 to begin promoting shows as Zanny Zalisco Presents. Zalisco's focus has always been on putting the right acts in the right places at the right time, with the right ticket prices in order to maintain fun and excitement for audiences and artists alike. DZP continues to bring top acts to the Phoenix area, as well as Las Vegas and Albuquerque. Please welcome legendary concert promoter and author Danny Zalisco to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Danny.
Hey, how you doing? How's some intro?
Hey, man, you got a lot going on.
How about that?
When I read these bios, a lot of people just go, man, I didn't know I did all that.
Well, I'm painfully aware that I did, but it sounds cool all at once. You know, it's like, what a barrage of great names. Very, very happy to hear it.
What's awesome is you're still young, man.
Yeah, well, Well, I appreciate that, but, you know, I qualify for Medicare. Ain't that young?
Well, we're probably very close in age. I gotta tell you, man, I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of music legends, and I'm very excited to talk to you because one of my great dreams has always been to be a concert promoter. I've owned several businesses. I was a, you know, I've been a music journalist for 10 years. You know, I've been a banker for 15 years, 16 years. You know, I know that kind of mentality. All my family grew up in New York, in Brooklyn and Bensonhurst, but, you know, the love of music is what drove me there, and I really admire you guys for doing what you do. I would have been your best customer if I lived out west.
Well, I wish you were out here because I could use a few customers like you.
I grew up in the D.C. area, and I was, you know, the admiration I had for Celador Concert was tremendous. Did you know those guys?
You're by my friend Seth Hurwitz.
Seth Hurwitz, IMP, right?
Yep. Yeah, we're good buddies.
Yeah, he's done really well.
Oh, yeah. He's had a great run just like me.
Exactly. It's amazing. You know, you were talking in an interview that you tell people not to do this. And there's a mentality, though, of being a concert promoter. I don't want to say, you know, disrespect or anything. It's almost you got to be half gangster to deal with all this, you know. And
well, I don't know about that.
No,
I've never been a gangster. I mean, really, what it boiled down to was in the 70s, as I grew into knowing that this is what I wanted to do, thinking it or liking the idea and doing it are completely different things.
Right.
And like, you know, a lot of people say, well, I've always wanted to be a concert promoter. I always wanted to be that guy that gets to walk around like you do. And, you know, you go backstage when you want to. And you do this, you do, you know, that's just all part of the gig. And I, believe me, I'm not playing it down. It's a big deal. And I know the people in front who monitor such activities are turned on by that. And there's a great mystique about the rock stars that they're paying to go to see to begin with. And then when you're finally there in the same space with them, whether it's 500 capacity or 15,000, you're in the space and you get to get touched musically and performance-wise by one of your favorite acts, or maybe somebody brought you to something that's new and you're learning about it for the first time. And what a great way to do that, which is live, and a band is at their peak and performing great. You know, it's an enjoyable job when everything goes right, but in order to make everything go right, it's a lot of details, mm-hmm. It's a lot of checklists, it's a lot of making sure, double-checking on everything, because just one small missed detail could cause you a show. I mean, for instance, if you forget to send somebody to pick the star up at the airport, and he's landing at 6 o'clock for an 8 o'clock show.
Right.
I've never had that happen, but I have had people miss planes before. I mean, I remember being at the waiting ramp. It was, what was before Southwest Airlines? I think it was Hughes Air West.
Okay.
It was a long time ago.
Right.
And I had Ozzy coming in to play a show on New Year's Day, not New Year's Eve. He did New Year's Eve in L.A. And they said, you sure you want to do that on New Year's Day? I said, I think it'll be a great day because it's a weekend and New Year's is over and people will want to go. Well, I was right. A lot of people wanted to come. But unfortunately for me, Ozzy had New Year's Eve in L.A. the night before and crippled himself as bad as, you know, a guy can do that on a New Year's Eve. You know, having a good time after the show. He didn't get off the plane. I got scared. I went to the desk. I said, where's Ozzy? Where's John Osborne? I didn't even say Ozzy. Mm-hmm. Where's John Osborne? And they said, oh, he's still on the plane. We're trying to get him off. And they had to bring one of those lifts over that do the wheelchairs.
Right.
And take him off the plane in a wheelchair.
Oh, man.
And I had to roll him to the car, and he could barely talk. He'd been up all night. He was having too much fun.
Yeah.
And all the way up until he got on the stage, he was in that state, and I was so worried that he wouldn't be able to do the show. And we got him to the top of the stage. Took three of us to get him up the stairs to the stage.
Jeez.
And the music started, and he gave us this fun little look in his eye, and he just burst out of the chair, running and laughing and pointing at us, laughing hysterically. I got you guys! I got you guys! it was a fun moment, and to be you know made like that was a great thing because it was in the right direction. I wasn't left high and dry, you know, with no show. So yeah. It's something else.
Are you scared?
You know, you have a strong heart for this too.
Oh yeah.
Stuff like that really does happen. In another Ozzy case, the second time he came in, we had him at the Coliseum, and at about 5 o'clock, the building director comes to me and says, "There's a hairline crack in the ceiling. We can't allow the show to be in there tonight."
Right.
And I said, "But all the lighting and all the sound is already hung.
Mm-hmm.
Are you telling me this place might cave in any second?" He goes, "Maybe." So we evacuated, and we had to move the show to another venue. It was a mess. But you know, when you're doing this promoter thing, you have to absolutely be prepared for anything to happen, and you certainly don't want to jinx it by thinking about what might happen. So don't think about what might happen, just be prepared. You know, I mean, for anything, because anything can happen. When you're doing concerts, you're talking about you know, about a million different details on 100 different people's checklists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the band has their people to do their stuff. The promoter has theirs. The building has theirs. The security, stagehands. I mean, there's a lot that goes into this. And that's why it's so magical, you know, so that at 8 o'clock you're in your chair and that show starts. And that's where the payoff is for all of us.
Yeah. I can't imagine, you know, I can see doing one concert, and that would probably take a lot out of me, but to line up, like, you know, 20 concerts or, you know, for a whole season, man, that's a lot of work.
It's a great juggling show because
yeah.
Everybody has to be on their toes about every single item on their list or you're burnt.
Right.
You know, I mean, people do not accept anything but perfection in what your various roles are, because it, you know, if you do accept anything other than perfection, something's going to be shown as a bad missed item on the list at a crucial time, you know, of the day or night of the show. So it's what tends to make promoters a little crazy, a little like cranky sometimes, or quick to point things out, because there's literally hundreds of details going on at any given show at any given time. Even now, for all the shows that have been postponed, that we had on the books,
that'd be a pain.
As of March 15th, we've now had to move those shows several times because we don't want to move them too far in the future, because I want to show my hope and my optimism of that we can return to having shows, which would signify returning back to normal, which is the bigger issue, sooner than later.
Exactly.
So, I mean, when concerts start happening like the way they used to, you'll know the world is okay.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we need music, man. I mean, we all depend on it, you know? That's our...
It's part of our personal stamp as a human being. I mean, for certain people, not for everybody, the ones that aren't in this group, they don't know what they're missing, but there is nothing like going to a show and seeing this event that's only going to happen one time.
Right.
You know, they're going to play a certain way that night, and they're going to play a little different the next night. Something different will happen every single night. So every night these groups are making history with you, and you show up, and you don't know what's going to happen. You could end up meeting somebody you become best friends with for the rest of your life, or even more. You could end up married to somebody, or you start dating. And just concerts open up so many different doors for everybody. Everybody in the building that night, from the promoter and the audience to the band and the people that work there. It's like, you never know who you're going to meet. You never know what's going to happen. And that's the beauty of it.
Danny, when I was a sophomore and before I started driving, I used to skip school, take a taxi cab, and he used to meet me in front of the school. I'd go to Montgomery Ward's to Ticketron and buy the latest concert tickets. That's how you know crazy I was. I mean, I lived and breathed rock concerts.
you have to develop your signature way of how to get the best seats.
Yep.
I mean, it's like going to war. It's like reconnaissance. It's very difficult.
It is.
You know, but you figure it out sooner or later. You figure out where to go where there aren't that many people. You know, or you make friends with somebody who runs one of those outlets, and you get them to print you a couple, like when it first goes on sale. It's always been a fascinating thing, the sale of tickets. Because when I started, we used to print up the tickets all at once. I'd print up, like, for the nightclub duties. I'd print up 750 general admission tickets.
Right.
And then I'd have to move them around to various stores when they went on sale, and then I'd have to go back and pick up the unsold and the money from those tickets the day of the show. You know, it's like every last thing you got to do.
Exactly. Yeah, and you got to have some people you can trust, too.
Oh, boy.
I got a job also when I was 16 at the Cap Center in Maryland, big arena there. And, you know, one of the reasons I got the job is to get tickets. And I remember getting tickets for the Rolling Stones. I was inside working. And I got front row seats because I worked there, you know. And I think tickets were like $9 or something like that.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That's a beautiful thing.
It's a beautiful thing. I work with a lot of guys. You know, I get calls all the time from the guys I interview asking me where are the venues. And, you know, they want to. I know all the promoters down here in the Tampa area, and a lot of times, you know, it's hard for them, especially now, to find the venues, you know, like in this area and whatever. And they want me to help them. I've actually helped them a couple of times, but I'm sure there's probably bands. Is there bands that you can't find a gig for? Has that ever happened? You know, the guys that are not, you know, exactly headliners.
Well, that happens all the time. I mean, you know, I've always been a great big believer in giving dates to the legends, whether they're on their way up or on their way down.
Right, right.
But when I say on their way down, I mean that they're not maybe they at their peak they sold 10,000 tickets.
Mm-hmm.
Most acts are not going to sell 10,000 seats for the remainder of their career.
Yeah.
Most groups will settle into a groove of like 2,000 or 3,000 or 1,500, you know, the music halls and the performing arts centers around the country where more adults tend to go. And keep in mind, as people get older, a lot of their favorite bands either retire or break up or sadly die.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, which is a weird thing that's happening to my generation, you know, which we've been around now since the 50s, and, you know, we're in the space now where it just seems so hard to believe and unusual that, you know, people expire in their 50s or their 60s or their 70s,
because
it seems like everybody's just getting ramped up and going, you know what I mean? You know, you finally get good at something, and then you got to expire. I mean, there's something wrong with that method.
It's sad. It really is.
It's a real shame.
Yeah. You know,
I wish I could keep promoting for another 20 or 30 years just to see what happens. You know, I mean, it's what I do, and it's interesting to be in the evolution of just what I've seen over the years. When we started doing concerts, we had to call in the agent, find out who the agent was, and then call him up, and then make an offer. And the way you made an offer was you had to go over every proposed expense with the agent by telephone. Most of the time, you've never met these guys, so you don't know what you're dealing with. And you got to go over every expense with them on the phone, and then when they're done and they're satisfied, they turn the offer in, and you get the show or you don't. But nowadays, then the fax machines came up, and then computers, you can make up offers in literally seconds or minutes and have your offers in no time. But in the old days, it took me a whole day to get offers together.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a completely different method of doing business, but it made it possible for me to go to different, different cities and get more than one show with an act while they're on tour.
Can you go over the mechanics a little bit of exactly how that works?
Sure.
Go ahead.
I'll give you a couple of examples. For instance, let's say you like a band. Doesn't matter who it is. And they've never been to your town before.
Okay.
That's like the first thing to look at. Because the Eagles don't need you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Taylor Swift and Ariana Grande and all the big names, whoever's touring, that's just a few, but Rolling Stones, they don't need strangers. They already have people they've been doing business with that help get them to where they're at right now.
Okay.
Who needs the help, who needs promoters to do the heavy lifting are the brand new bands.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, older groups that have kind of like fallen by the wayside, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
but they're still as good as ever
right.
because there's still an audience out there and their name's already broken. So it's a matter then of where should this band play?
Exactly.
Where would their audience go?
Right.
Where do similar audiences go for these type of shows? What's the favorite one in the community? When you wrap that up, when you get the right place, the right group, and you figure out the price of how much you're going to pay them, which you need to know a whole different set of things about. You got to know what did they do the last time they played in the market, or previous times. But the last time is usually the most significant. Is there some sort of a role? Is there momentum going one way or the other? You know, that's why you want to know more than one in the past. You want to know two or three. So you got to get a hold of those statistics in order to make the proper offer this time for that group. Many times when I'm making deals, the agent will say, hey, how come you're offering me less this time than last time? And I said, well, last time, this is what I should have paid you because I overpaid you and I lost money.
Yeah.
The bottom line is like, say you're paying somebody $25,000.
Right.
Figure on top of that $25,000, you're going to spend another $30,000 to $40,000 in other costs to put on the show.
Okay.
Let's call it 30 just for the hell of it.
Okay.
If you have a 1,500 seat place.
Right.
And it costs you $25,000 for the headliner. And another $30,000 for all of your advertising, the hall rental, the labor, the stagehands, insurance, all that stuff. And it'll easily get to $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're getting the hall for free, which doesn't happen. That's $55,000. Think on top of that, you're gonna have tax. Now you're at $60,000. You need to sell 1,500 tickets at $40.
Mm-hmm.
Just to break even.
Yeah.
So, 1,500 might not sound like a lot of tickets to you, because you know of all these other big bands in your mind that sell out arenas, but let me tell you something. The thing about 1,500 seats is you have a lesser audience, which means it's harder to find them, because they're not as big as those groups. The groups that are 10,000, 15,000 and sell out, I mean, the minute those things are announced, you call somebody else, they call somebody else, they call somebody else, and the next thing you know, it's sold out the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Because those groups are hot, and they're in demand. But take any of these great, you know, classic rock bands,
mm-hmm.
and folk singers, you know, all these great people, and their audience is now around 1,500, maybe 2,500. But you need people, I mean, you're drawing from a bigger audience than that, because keep this in mind. We have to end up picking out a date to play, which we always hope is a Friday or Saturday,
right.
and it rarely is, because they have to route these tours in such a way where they go from Chicago down to St. Louis,
right.
and over to Oklahoma and Texas, then into New Mexico, then to Arizona, then to California. They call that routing a tour,
mm-hmm.
and you want to route the tour as closely together,
sure.
city-wise, as possible so the band doesn't have to travel so far. Most bands by car won't travel more than 400 miles overnight. Some will go more, but 400 is usually about the limit. So that means you could play Phoenix and L.A. back-to-back, or you could play Phoenix and Albuquerque back-to-back. But you couldn't play Albuquerque to Tucson or San Diego, for example, because that extra hour or two will put a driver on the bus over the limit that
right.
they allow I mean, there's all the stuff that goes into figuring out how your concert's going to happen. And, you know, I mean, think of how many steps we're already at, and we haven't even gone on sale yet.
Yeah.
You know, so once you get your band, you agree on a deal,
right.
You agree on a date, you agree on the hall, then you have to advertise it,
mm-hmm.
and you have to announce when it's going to go on sale so people know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to deal with everybody's fan clubs that they insert in there, so they get better tickets because they paid the band more money to join a fan club that gives them bragging rights to be in front of everybody else. So your choice is either to join that fan club or join American Express because they paid out millions for the right to get the first Abbott tickets. We get none of that money. That's between the band
right.
and the groups. So, you know, there's a lot of looking the other way when it comes to this, or when the bands do their meet and greets.
Yep.
Used to be we could give away 10 meet and greets.
Mm-hmm.
That happens very rarely anymore because they sell these meet and greets now, which I find horrid to begin with.
I know.
But it is expensive to be on the road,
mm-hmm.
and these people go, you know, they fed it into the artist that, hey, so-and-so's doing this, and so-and-so's doing this, so, you know, you might as well do it. You could pick up an extra $1,000. I mean, when Aerosmith's out, they're $1,500 for a meet and greet with Joe and Steve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, $1,500.
That's crazy.
You know, so at the end of the night, they do 50 of those. That's $75,000.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all theirs. We have to orchestrate it for them.
Yep.
And you know what? Everybody wants to meet these guys, so the way they figured is, hey, if they're willing to pay for it, we might as well make it worth their while.
Yeah.
A lot of those people do donate that money to charities, and they don't even say it. A lot of them are very good about that.
Good.
And that's what they should be doing.
Right.
For them to spend an hour of their time staying alone to their fans and get paid for it, I hope they're sharing it.
Yeah, me too.
You know.
Now, the merchandising, that's all them too, right? You don't get a piece of that?
No, that's all theirs.
That's all
theirs. The only way I would get a piece of that is if I own the hall.
Okay.
Because it's the hall that gets the percentage of the merchandise. I never figured out how that ended up like that, but that's how it works.
Hmm.
Usually, I guess it's because the hall started by selling their own concessions, you know, Cokes, water,
right,
whatever.
Right.
And then it turned into something else being sold in their building. But, you know, to me, I feel like that should be my money. I'm renting the building for the night.
That's true.
You know,
I agree.
It's very, and this is why I tell people, if they're thinking about becoming promoters, don't. I mean, it took me 5 years. It took me 5 years before I started getting paid any kind of regular
money.
Prior to that, it was all sporadic,
it's one by one,
whenever I could get myself into a gig. It was very difficult at first, and it's difficult for anybody to start any vocation whatsoever, much less this one. I mean, everybody wants in this business, just like I did, but I didn't know what I had to offer, what I could do. And as far as they're concerned, if you want to be a promoter, you better have some money so you can put down deposits on the groups when you buy their show.
Right.
You're going to have to pay money to the hall to hold the hall,
right.
You know, a rental fee. And you're going to have to pay for your advertising if nobody knows who you are.
Yeah.
After you do this for a long time, they're willing to extend you credit.
Yeah.
But you better plan on coming in, you know, with some dough. You know, I wish I could coach people on how to do it without having a stake in it. And it'd be interesting to help start off some new promoters. Because I know there's a lot of people out there that really do enjoy music and dream about, wow, wouldn't it be great to make money listening to music? And the answer is yes, it's a great thing. But, careful, those waters are murky.
Yeah. I know. I pay money for your school. I would. I mean, this is something I really wanted to do. I almost did it buying a nightclub in Georgetown in D.C., the Crazy Horse, which was there for a long time. And I had a friend of mine that, I don't know if you heard of a club called Jack's, Jay Nedry. He was a promoter, and he brought in all these acts into his club. And he did a good job. He did it for many, many years. So I was going to do kind of the same thing, and he was kind of mentoring me on it and everything. But then I thought, you know, I'm never going to see my wife again.
Well, so that's a good reason to do it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I hope your wife's not around.
You're right. But you see, in my case, when I was much younger, in my 20s and 30s, I had all that energy to go out
right.
and do that every night. It gets old not having a normal life, but yep. it's fun not having a normal life. You know, it can be very, very rewarding. But, you're not going to be home a lot if you're doing a lot of shows. I mean, for example, my company, Danny Zelenko Presents, has been doing, 125 shows a year or so.
It's amazing.
Since I got back on my own in 2011, but prior to that, with Evening Star, our biggest year was 450 shows in 1 year.
Jeez, that's crazy.
So one day we had 7 shows in 1 day.
Wow.
I can't remember who it was. I should have, but there was a lot of dates. Three and four shows the same day was regular.
Wow.
In different cities, we would go. We started here, and then we got Vegas, we got Albuquerque and Santa Fe, Tucson, and then it spread out from there. We started to do more and more cities sometimes. But you see, there was guys like me in most of those markets to begin with, so it was easier not to go in there and challenge them and try to take over there, because all you're doing is asking them to do the same thing to you where you live, and you don't want that. So there was never an organized kind of a conspiracy about that,
mm-hmm.
but it was just kind of like one of those, let's leave well enough alone.
Yeah.
Let's enjoy doing shows where we live.
Sure.
And then you look for those extra dates in markets where people don't exist,
mm-hmm.
as far as promoters that can handle certain things. And that's how you can end up making some good dough, is by having more than one date.
Danny, how, two things. How is, the casinos in Vegas, and how is major, sports in general? I mean, Major League, the football, we have, Tampa, we're going to have the Super Bowl, and there's hardly going to be anybody there. How are these guys staying alive during this?
We all got our own problems, don't we, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. Look, casinos, for example, I would imagine have been putting away a lot of money for a long time, but then they distribute it, at the end of the year, however they share their winnings. I don't know how deep anybody else's pockets are. I don't even know how deep mine are exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that I'm still able to try to continue doing what we're doing here with no income, which
right.
is very ridiculously hard.
Yep.
You really got to watch everything, because you want to last and stretch out, paying people as long as you possibly can until you don't have any more money. You got to save enough for yourself to be there when this all returns. So in Vegas, I know they haven't opened up full capacity, but I know that theoretically there's not a ton of people going there.
There's not.
In a fair mind with the right spirit to go enjoy Vegas the way you normally would because of this pandemic out there. I mean, it's kind of puts a damper on things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It seems unusual not to go out and party in mass droves, just like it's very difficult for me to think about people staying home. But the fact is these numbers, I don't think they lie. I don't think they put them out there for any other reason other than to inform us what's going on. And bottom line is we got to get those numbers to go backwards like we had before.
Right.
But right now these numbers are so out of control. I don't know how Vegas is doing it. I haven't been up there since this all started.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't been in any casinos to see what they're doing. I really haven't even been to the one here, but except for one time, and there wasn't much going on. I just went over there to see somebody. But it's anything to do with the live business, including sports, church, food stores, grocery stores, whatever. I mean, it's really affected everybody's business. So we're hoping these vaccines, the first one comes through and works for everybody, and then the second one.
Mm-hmm.
The clothing vaccine. I pray these things work just like everybody else. You never would think you had to pray to want your old life back. Like, I mean, I thought my life was pretty good before. Mm-hmm. This has really knocked it down a notch or two. And I want the regular stuff back.
Exactly.
I want to not be seeing people on TV that are running the government only thinking of themselves.
Right.
If that much, I want people thinking of everybody. I want everybody to do their jobs.
Sure.
The right way, so yeah. That God forbid this never happens again. This is, it's just awful. And I know people are sick of hearing that. They know it's awful. But, you know, in the meantime, on the brighter side, I suggest you go out and buy a copy of the book All Access,
yep.
Available at dcplive.com or the Kindle on Amazon. It's a fun book, and yep. It will take you away from all this madness for a few hours. And I think anything that can make you feel good that has something to do with music is always a great thing. So that's why, you know, we had the time this last year to finally put all this together. But, you know, I found notes for this book that I had as early as 2011. I have a list of 60% of what went into the book 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's what I do. I do the same thing. Yep.
Yeah. The thing that I didn't do those 9 years ago is take each one of those hits,
mm-hmm.
each one of those line items, and turn it into a story. Because if I had done that, this book would have been done 5 years ago. Or even more before that. But, you know, in the first part of this decade, I was working on building a new company, and there really wasn't the time to be doing this book. It took up a lot of time to do this, you know, gathering all the stories
yep.
and the pictures and approvals from people for some picture
yeah.
use, and then getting it printed and yep. getting a good cover and getting a good name. And then you got to package them and mail them out. Fortunately for us, White Castle gave us a couple thousand Crave clutch boxes.
That's funny.
They sent it to us flat. We just fold them together, and it fits the book perfectly. We send out some coupons for White Castle.
I love White Castle.
And I've got a bookmark in there from which is a concert ticket reproduction for my first show. And we sent a couple of disposable wine glasses so you can have dinner and a show.
That's awesome.
While reading the book.
That's awesome. That's all. You got
to add a little something extra to it.
You got to get Harold and Kumar to promote it.
Right? Well,
yeah.
I'll tell you what, they're in the White Castle Hall of Fame. I would love to meet them sometime. I'm hoping once all this stuff is over, we're going to be able to have, you know, the Hall of Fame class meet up in Columbus and, you know, and everybody meet each other. And I'm hoping White Castle is going to continue putting fans of White Castle into their Cravers Hall of Fame as time goes on. They're really fun people, nice folks.
Mm-hmm.
They've been around as long as, I think they're the oldest.
I think so.
Oldest fast food restaurant in existence.
Yeah.
I can't imagine anybody older than them.
Yeah.
And it's really been fun, you know, tag teaming with them and promoting fun stuff, music and fast food. I mean, what's more fun than that? A jet ski, you know.
Exactly. And also the Saturday Night Fever. They did a little section there at White Castle when they were all at White Castle, and the one guy starts eating the burger and he jumps up on the table and starts barking like a dog.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Funny stuff, huh?
I gotta ask you, did you work with Peter Grant on the Zeppelin show?
I never worked with Peter
right.
directly. No, I worked on the Zeppelin show that I worked with Bill Graham. I was a nobody at that show. When I say I worked with Bill Graham, don't get a high and mighty vision there. My first job of the day was lining trash containers.
That starts somewhere.
At 6 a.m. it was about 40 degrees and I was dying. And, you know, but anyway, I worked at that show and I saw Peter Grant at that show. I met him.
Uh-huh.
Huge guy.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, very, very tough guy. Later on that decade was when they had all the troubles, up there in San Francisco
right.
with Mr. Grant, and, a lot of problems came out of that, and it was a shame that happened, but yeah, I don't know him at all. I know a lot of people that do though, or knew him.
Yeah. You and Brian Piccolo, that's an amazing story, too. That's also in the book, I guess.
Yeah, it belongs in there because for many, many reasons. Prior to getting involved with music and promoting music and shows, I was a big sports fan, mm-hmm. and I had become accustomed to this. I haven't figured out yet the right way to say this. But I got used to the stardom of Bears players and of Cubs players mm-hmm. by being around them at Wrigley Field when they would show up to park and walk across the street to go in for their game. And so we would have them for a minute or two as they walked around, and we intuitively, most of us, intuitively got this good measure of good behavior, how to behave around these people so they don't give you that look like, get away from me, you're bothering me.
Exactly.
You know, it's like everything in life.
Yeah.
Half of life is fitting in.
Right.
You have to belong or figure out how to belong in any given scenario in order to find out what happens next or be involved in what happens next. But you're ruled out if you're a jerk
mm-hmm.
or if you don't know how to behave and you're all giddy and
true.
Silly and stupid.
Yep.
You know, you're never going to get to be around that person longer than an autograph and how you doing. So that happened with Piccolo when I first met him. I mean, he thought I was nutty for not chasing one of the more popular Bears mm-hmm. players who were showing up at the same time. I was the only one with him. I had him to myself for that 5 or 10 minutes. We just talked. And I enjoyed him, and I enjoyed his company, as I think he did mine, and then I was there every week for those practices, and I got to meet him more and more. We got to know each other better and better. We became friends mm-hmm. to the point where I called him up one night. I had his phone number. We talked on the phone
wow.
all the time, and I asked him if he wanted to do his speaking engagement to my little league, and he said, sure.
Hmm.
And we negotiated the fee. I went back to the guy who offered $200. They said, he wants $300 and steak dinner for me and him. He goes, done. Because he'd only offered $200 before that. So, you know, in that very young age,
yeah.
completely different business, sports, oh, but, you know, sports has its similarity
it
to rock because you got to buy a ticket to get in.
Yeah.
Same as a baseball game. And there's people that people look up to playing sports just like music. And it was amazing how closely they do run together because it's about mass assembly and watching talented people do their thing in front of you. It's really remarkable when you think about it, you know, that how good these people got to get paid the money they get paid to
yep.
do what they do
yep.
in front of people willing to pay the admission price mm. to get in so these people get paid.
Exactly.
It's really remarkable
yeah.
when you think about it.
It is. That's a great story about with the Piccolo thing, though. That's a great story.
Yeah. I told some people that after it happened, and they said, oh, you're full of it. That didn't happen. That couldn't happen. Well, I said, no, really. He gave me $30.
Yeah.
On a $300 show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's the first time I ever heard of the concept of a commission.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, he was a great one. But, you know, and he also taught me about humility and, mm-hmm. and being a good guy and you know, family. And I already had that instilled in me from my family, but this was one of the first guys that I got that same great vibe from. Who was obviously into the same things as me,
yeah.
other than the fact he was much bigger than me and he could play football
right.
really well.
Yeah.
So it's a real eye-opener, you yeah. know, being around those folks.
It
turned out in my case to be a really good thing. It wasn't about being starstruck. It was mm-hmm. more about, you know, letting them be struck by me and getting along with me. You know, I kind of tried to turn that around and it was so much fun.
I can't believe we lost Gale Sayers recently, you know? I mean,
I just saw him. Well, I shouldn't say just. I haven't seen him for several years. The last time I saw him was he was signing autographs at a thing by the Mandalay Bay in Vegas, and I was doing a Bob Seger show there. And I went in and dropped by to say hello to him. I reminded him of how I'd known him in the 60s. But, you know, that was, what, 10, 20, 30,
right.
35 years earlier. I mean, how many autographs, how many kids did Gail Sayers and those guys see?
Yeah.
But I reminded him of it. It seemed like it got through to him. I couldn't make sure of it until later that night. I was at the Seeger show making a turn on the main floor to go backstage right at the end of the show. And he saw me and he comes running after me yelling my name.
Hmm.
He goes, "You didn't tell me this was your show." I said, "You didn't ask. I didn't know you were going." He goes, "I gotta meet Seeger. I gotta meet him." So I brought him backstage and he met the whole band.
Awesome.
And he thought it was the greatest thing ever.
Awesome.
I mean, this is, you know, this is one of their idols. We're all in the same kind of age group, so that, and most from the Midwest. And, you know, the Lions and the Bears rivalry was legendary, and so everybody there had seen him play before. So, anyway, it was great. It's great fun to have that happen. It was magic.
I was a big Baltimore Colts fan. I was actually born in Baltimore, and Gale Sayers just killed us, you know, every time we played Bears.
You know, I was friends with several Baltimore Colts as a result of seeing them year after year.
Yep.
At Wrigley, but I became friends with Raymond Berry and Don Shinnick.
Wow.
And two of the greatest Colts there ever were.
Unitas to Berry, touchdown.
Yep. And I met and Jimmy Orr, too.
Jimmy Orr.
A really cool guy.
Yeah. You know, in my opinion, the greatest football player ever, when you think of football, to me, I think it's still Dick Butkus, you know?
It's kind of hard to say the greatest because you got to have somebody on the other side of the ball, too.
Well, yeah, maybe defense, I guess.
he didn't have a long career, but boy, was it wild. You know, I mean, you got to think about people like Ray Nitschke in there.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I mean, there's so many great players. But Ray Butkus is a great choice. Sayers is also a great choice for the best runner. But you got guys out there nowadays.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys are amazing.
They are amazing.
They're 6'4", 260.
Yeah.
Can you imagine getting run over by that guy when you're a 195-pound cornerback? I mean, God.
Yeah.
And they're at full speed, and they run fast. Holy cow.
Yeah, they're in better shape nowadays, you know? They're much better.
I'm glad I switched careers.
Did you play football?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I got run over pretty bad, and that was the end of my career. I got a third squad on the B team, and they put me in on the A team one day, and I just got leveled.
Mm.
And that was that. I was done.
Yeah.
I just wasn't tall enough or fast enough.
Yeah.
I was a good thrower and I could run okay, but not the way these guys are. These guys, they're trained assassins.
So you're a quarterback?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a quarterback. Huh.
And I also did the cornerback thing.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of memorable plays, but not much of anything. It was fun to play while I could, but between not getting big enough to play those kind of sports, and music, you know, the late 60s coming along at the same time. And this is when you're making your decisions as a 15, 16, 17-year-old about your future. Are you going to follow the baseball path, which I really wanted to? I was a really good catcher. I thought anyway, and I was a good hitter, and I could do it. But music came along, and I found myself spending more time listening to music. And really getting boned up on that as opposed to, you know, really wanting to play sports that much anymore.
Danny, the same thing happened to me, man. In high school, I made that decision. They wanted me to try out for the baseball team. I was a good hitter. And I started growing my hair out long and going to rock concerts, and that was it. It was over.
Yeah.
Same thing. Yep.
Yeah. That's what happens.
Yeah. But my claim to fame, like you with Piccolo, I spent 3 hours with Ted Williams.
Wow. How was that?
I had a store in D.C. I had several businesses in D.C. on near Pennsylvania Avenue, and he walks in, and he loves gadgets, and he bought a couple of shortwave radios and a few things, and then I had to teach him about his camera, and really nice guy, man. He's the real, genuine John Wayne, you know? And that's how he talked, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, he's a piece of work.
He was cool.
What a guy.
What a guy, huh?
What a guy.
Yeah. Danny, here's a question I ask everybody. I get some very interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, you know, like the movie, to work, promote, with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Work or promote? Well, I would have loved to have. I would have loved to have done the Beatles, just like I would have loved to have done something with Dean Martin, maybe with Jerry Lewis. I would have loved to have done that. I did get to work with three of the Beatles, but not the fourth one, John.
Right.
It would have been nice in more recent times. I mean, wouldn't it have been great to, if you know, to somehow get in the middle of a Beatles show promoting that? Led Zeppelin, I never promoted Led Zeppelin per se. Mm-hmm. I did Page and Plant.
Right.
And I've done shows with all of them, but I didn't do Led Zeppelin. That would have been, I still wish that would happen. It could happen so easily. I would love to think that somebody's blowing in their ear saying, you know, guys, come on, we're coming out of a pandemic, but
yeah,
with a mighty, mighty big celebration.
Right.
You know, like, do that show that's broadcast around the world on the same day, at the same time, live, and have every amphitheater and every drive-in theater and every movie theater filled with mm-hmm. people welcoming back live music with Led Zeppelin. Wouldn't that be great? I'd love to see that happen with Pink Floyd as well.
Yeah.
I did Pink Floyd before, so that's not on that list. You know, I mean, and then going back, wouldn't it have been great to, like, put on Beethoven gigs?
Oh, man.
I would have loved that.
Wow.
But he was pretty ornery, I understand, and a tough guy to deal with. I mean, here's this great composer with an ear problem, you know, and he had to teach somebody with ears how to play his own music. He, in fact, he created the first tribute show, when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because people have been playing Beethoven since before he died because he couldn't anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, just like Steve Perry joined Journey and was a new singer in that, and he made his mark so heavy on it, everybody that's a Journey fan thinks Steve Perry's part of the original Journey, which he isn't. And,
right.
And then there's other people that have replaced him since then, and they're still a Journey.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, if you really want to think about it, that all started back then where parts are replaceable when making music.
You know, I'm not a big fan of that, though. You know, like when they replace.
Well, you better be, because you're not going to see anybody.
I know. But when they replace.
I wish it was different, too, but
yeah.
What would you rather have? Would you rather have the Rolling Stones broken up because Brian Jones and Bill Wyman quit or died?
No, but you still got Keith and Mick.
Yeah, but see, but like in Styx, you got Tommy Shaw.
Right.
And you got J.Y.
Right.
Right?
That's fine.
You got Chuck the bass player, but you don't have Dennis DeYoung. But you got Lawrence, who's fantastic, and he basically became Dennis DeYoung.
But then you got guys like the Little River Band, who's got no members. You know, that's the kind of thing I don't like. You know?
Well, you know, the problem is with that, is in the Little River Band, there is one guy. But the people that ended up stealing the name were the people that got into the group as replacements.
Right. I know.
And they ended up getting the name, you know, trademarked and all that. I mean, it's, guess who? The same thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
Burton Cummings and Randy Bachman.
Yeah, same thing.
Can't say the guess who.
You're right.
Because the bass player trademarked the name.
Yeah.
So the guess who tours, the guy that trademarked the name doesn't even tour anymore, and he gets all the royalties, and he pays those guys a salary to be guess who.
I know all the guys from Yes, the original band. I've had them on the show many, many times. I can't go watch Yes without John Anderson and Squire, and, you know, it's not the same. I can't do that.
Well, it's not the same if you're going to the show expecting it to be the same, but if you want to hear Yes music reproduced live as good as it can, that's where you go.
Yeah.
You know, and if you've already been to it, maybe you choose not to go back another time. It really depends. That whole brand has been pretty beat up over the years.
It has, and
you know, it just shows how strong it is.
Yeah.
Because it's still a force to this day.
Yep.
Anderson Wakeman and Trevor Rabin did it. I mean, their show was very solid, and you wonder why couldn't they just go back and play together? And basically, what it boils down to, it's like a marriage breaking up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, when you first meet somebody and you're dating them and courting them and getting married and all that stuff, it's all like you're fresh at the beginning.
Yep.
But time has a way of wearing things down.
Yep.
And you find out more and more about that person. And finally, they do something you just can't handle anymore.
Yep. True.
You know, and it happens. You know, and I don't know if bands are supposed to stay together for their entire lives any more than are people supposed to stay together.
Yep.
You like to think, yes, it'd be positive. It's very nice. But the reality is it's very difficult. You know, when you take like four teenage boys who start a band and then money starts coming in and now along the way they're meeting people and they're dating and they're getting married and next thing you know they're having kids and suddenly they have regular problems just like the rest of the world and you wonder why they can't stay together as a band.
Yeah.
It's a difficult juggling show there. You know, especially in this business, everybody's got to go to work. Everybody's got to leave their kids and their wife or their husband and go out and do what they got to do to earn money. But, you know, in this business, for up to 9 months a year, you're away. You know, if you're a touring band. And it's very difficult to have a good private life, you know, and tour the way that you need to in order to stay out in front of people.
You know, a lot of these guys too, with the pandemic, they're, you know, some guys are thinking about retiring. They're actually enjoying being with family at this time too.
Well,
you know?
sure they are. And you know, look, the bottom line is, I think this would be a very wrong time for any band to say, oh, that's it, I'm done.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to have to overcome another hurdle. In the event that right. you change your mind and you want to come out and play.
Right.
You know, so it's like, hey, let's see what happens. We're keeping our fingers crossed. There's nothing wrong with being optimistic.
Yeah.
I'm hoping we'll have shows. I've been hoping for Memorial Day. I'm starting to see those possibilities fade a little bit. You know, it's turning into Labor Day.
Hmm.
Cause think about it. I mean, I tried today to get a vaccine and I couldn't get through. They opened up the portals today
mm-hmm.
for January and February or right. February and March and I could not get through. There's that many people applying for it. I don't know if I'm going to get any special dispensation because look, you want me to live. I'm going to bring your shows to you.
Yeah.
So I am a public servant.
Sure.
To agree.
Yeah, I agree.
But I haven't convinced anybody of that yet. I'd like to get in there and get that one, and I'd like to get that second one, and I'd really like to help lead a charge against, you know, turning this thing the other way
right.
so that we can go back to normal.
Danny, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, other alternative ways to present shows, like from your car, you know, these shields around you. Can't they do anything like that? Is that possible?
Well, they've done it. Some people have done it, and I've gotten mixed reviews from people. Personally, I've seen a lot of shows, so I'm not craving to just go to a show under any circumstances just to see a show. I want to see who I want to see, and then I want to know what the conditions are of how I'm going to go. But sitting on the hood of a car or sitting inside of my car with speakers mm-hmm. or dialed into a radio station. So, you know, that's good for the 4th of July when you're doing fireworks.
Right.
I don't know that I want to do that. I haven't done it though. And I understand when groups want to do that because they got to earn money somehow. And I understand why people who go to concerts will go and do that because they just need concerts. So for those people, by all means, do it. Go ahead and do those things, and I hope you have a good time, Adam. I'm just not personally into that.
Right.
You know, the idea of selling 100 cars at $100 a head, or $100 a car,
mm-hmm.
that's $10,000.
Yeah.
Who am I going to get to play for 10 grand
right.
and then pay for my expenses that anybody's going to want to see? People just don't want to go see anybody. They want to see their band.
Sure.
And they want to see them in the right room. And they're willing to pay to see them in the right room. So, you know, I mean, you don't see Bruno Mars out at the drive-in. You know, and he could do it. I mean, he's the kind of guy that could do it. But think of what a disappointment that would be for so many fans who wouldn't be able to get in if he played in one of these restricted type capacities.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you turn a good intention into a bad outcome.
True.
That way, I think. And so anyway, you know, some of the stuff online has been good. I've seen a few of those things.
Right.
But it's not the way I really want my music delivered to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it is nice to catch up with people that take the time and the initiative out to do some sort of a visit online or for perhaps play. I mean, I think that, to me, that's a little more, I think, better than going to a drive-in or standing in a parking lot. Or
yeah. Danny had a question that just came up to me. You know, when bands are big, you know, like Ringo's all-star band, I cover Ringo. I've been invited to his shows and stuff like that. But it's a big band, you know. How do they make any money? And do they, what are their fees? It didn't seem like their fees would be too high because they tour a lot. How does that work?
Well, what do you mean? Are they doing shows?
Well, they're doing shows, but how can they afford to pay the band? You know what I mean?
What show are they doing?
Well, like the All-Star Band, Ringo's All-Star Band.
Are they playing somewhere?
Yeah, they're playing Ruth Eckert Hall in Clearwater. They're on tour. They'll be on tour again.
When?
Ruth Eckert is probably it's probably near the end of this year.
They're okay.
Scheduled.
So I don't understand the question.
How does Ringo pay the band? Because there's a lot of people in the band. You know, it's not like four guys in the band.
Okay.
You know?
Well, I can't address particularly. But obviously, he's getting guaranteed enough money, or they wouldn't take the show.
Because, you know, normally he plays smaller halls now. He doesn't.
How big is Ruth Eckert?
I think it's about 6,000 or something like that.
So I don't understand the question. If he sells tickets, he'll make. Here, put it this way. No matter what, Ringo's not going into his pocket to pay the band, number one.
Right.
Number two, whoever the promoter is, obviously guaranteed him enough money so that he can cover all of his costs and make a profit. Ringo doesn't do anything for free.
Right.
So, you know, bottom line there is we all have shows where we're scheduled from last year, from March through the end of the year. We had to move all these shows later and later and later to accommodate this pandemic. And hopefully one day the pandemic is going to stop and these dates that we keep changing stop getting changed. We actually put on the show.
Yeah. I just made a big mistake. Ruth Eckert's only 2,100 seats.
Okay.
So
figure on a Ringo show, they're going to probably average $125 a ticket.
I get it free.
Well, I'm not talking about you.
I know.
Yeah, no, but I mean, you're asking how can he make it work?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they have to multiply out. You have to come up with a ticket scam, scenario, I should say. Or ticket scam.
The truth is coming out.
But they have to figure out how many tickets they have to charge how much for to accommodate Ringo's fee. I'm not sure what his fee is in that hall. And keep in mind, like I said before, they have to go from one place to another to another. Sometimes groups will pick up smaller dates along the way in order to get from A to C. You know, they'll pick up B somewhere else in a smaller place or just, you know, than they're used to. But then it turns into how much are you making a week or a month, then do we make enough to cover the cost for our tour?
Yeah, it just seems to me that it seems like it's on both ends. It seems like they're, I just don't see how they can, you know, make a lot of money in it.
Well, I'm still not sure what's a lot of money. If they're charging enough money, like to do a $250,000 gross,
yeah,
which you can easily do at Ruth Eckert Hall, they're paying Ringo his fee.
Right.
And they're going to end up with plenty of money to cover their expenses. And they also, the hall gets their food and beverage, you know, drinks and stuff as well.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that.
I mean, nobody's, on a Ringo Starr show with 2,100 seats, nobody should be losing money because you can charge almost anything you want to see him in a proper hall like that.
Tickets are $63.75 to $228.75.
There you go. they're making it work.
And they got platinum ticket prices at $338 to $900. That's great.
There you go.
Yeah. I see what you
mean. You know, that's what those, you know, those platinum ticket packages, VIP seating,
right.
All the rest of that stuff.
That's where they come in.
All of that stuff goes into their pot.
Yep.
That contributes to how much they're going to walk out with at the end of the night.
Yeah.
So the deals can vary based on that.
Yep. I see it now. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Danny, you got anything else for me? The book is wonderful. 5 stars all the way. It's probably the best book about concert promoting ever in history.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that. I really am, and I appreciate that. My hope is that people will buy the book and enjoy it and tell their friends about it. We put a lot of work into this thing. It's been a long time coming. But that's not a reason to buy a book. The reason to buy a book is that it's got, you know, enough of your favorites in it so that, you know, you're willing to dedicate a little spare cash to buying this. But I like to think that right now having this as a companion kind of helps, not replaces, but helps fill in the void of not being able to go to shows, because you got a concert promoter telling you what happened that you didn't know before, and maybe the next time you go to a concert, some of this stuff will be triggered and come to mind. You'll have a little laugh to yourself about it, going, yeah, I remember when he said this about that situation or whatever. I mean, the bottom line, the goal is to bring people closer to the equation of what I've been lucky enough to do my whole life and see, you know, a little bit of what's happening under the blankets.
I sent Kenny Kramer, who's the original Kramer from Seinfeld, that the guy they based the whole show on. I sent him my book, and he keeps it right by his bedside. And because you know, I've got over 45 interviews with all these music legends, and your book's the same. You know, it's like a coffee table book, and you know, it's right there. You know, anytime you're just sitting around, you pick it up, you read it, and it, you know, it's very enjoyable. You know, it's perfect.
I'm really glad to hear you say that, and thanks for having me on your show to talk about it more.
Danny, it's been a pleasure, man. I mean, I've been looking forward to this interview, and you know, I really appreciate what you do. And if it wasn't for you, man, I probably wouldn't have made it in life. I'm serious.
That's very sweet. Thanks. But I have a feeling you would have done just fine. But thanks for that,
Danny. I'll send you a copy of my book. I'll see. You know.
Oh, I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I'd love to send it to you.
Send it over.
I will, man.
All right,
Danny. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Take care, man. Bye bye.
Okay.
Purchase Danny Zalisco's new book, All Access Occupation Concert Promoter. Fantastic book, great read, great coffee table book, always there when you need it. It's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book. It's available at Amazon.com right now. All Access Occupation Concert Promoter, the new book by Danny Zalisco. This is the second edition of the original book, Landscape Style Layout. Makes it the perfect coffee table book, making the book even more unique and valuable. It is signed by the author, Danny Z, 4 years in the making. Enjoy all 360 pages, busting with stories and over 700 never-before-seen photos from Danny's personal collection from over the years. The foreword was written by baseball legend and live music fan Kirk Gibson. Pictures and stories featuring Zeppelin, Alice Cooper, the Beatles, the Grateful Dead, as well as Chicago Bears sports legend Brian Piccolo. Also Gale Sayers and the Cubs Ernie Banks, along with so many more. The book chronicles Danny's childhood passion for collecting memorabilia and autographs all the way through his rise to becoming Arizona's premier concert promoter. For a limited time, get your edition shipped to you in the classic White Castle Crave Clutch box, complete with coupons for free burgers while supplies last. That is awesome. For more information about Danny Zalisco Presents, visit www.DannyZaliscoPresents.com, his official website. Also, he's on Facebook, www.Facebook.com/DannyZaliscoPresents. And he's also on Twitter. Very special thanks to Kathy Kotz, Prusheski, And Danny Zalisco presents, and for arranging this interview, and also with Danny Zalisco, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio, for making this magic happen for each and every broadcast of interviewing the legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It is real news, people. And then there's my book. My book entitled The Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1, which chronicles truths, confessions, and wisdom from the music legends that set us all free. You can order yours today on hardcover, the collector's edition hardcover, or ebook at bookbaby.com and amazon.com. It features over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends the world will ever know. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. And peace, good health, stay safe, and God bless. Bye-bye now.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.